Hey, everybody. It's Greg Gutfeld, otherwise known as The One, your favorite one from The Five. I'm excited. I'm always excited, though, but I'm extra excited because I'm going to be interviewing a really interesting character named, he's a professor, Gad Saad. He's a university professor in Canada. He specializes in evolutionary psychology. I think I'm a little out of breath because I was running around, but try to ignore that. But he wrote a great book. That's how I discovered him. It's called The Consuming Instinct, which I not only read, but I underlined a ton of crap. And I underlined so much crap that it was like useless to underline it because it was just like I couldn't figure out what was important and what wasn't important because I just underlined everything. He has I think he still has a blog on Psychology Today. But what he's become known for, even though he specializes in evolutionary psychology, he's kind of known for his YouTube videos, which are called The Sad Truth. And he's had loads of interesting people on, including, I think, me, but people that you know in the blogosphere. And I won't say who they are because they're just not as important as my guest or me, for that matter. But on his YouTube videos, he goes after PC culture, multiculturalism, trigger warnings, and he's kind of been ahead of the curve on a lot of this stuff. So I wanted to get him on here, and I think everybody will be excited. Dr. Saad, how you doing?
How are you, sir? Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, definitely. By the way, you are exactly 1 month younger than me.
Is that right?
Yes.
But perhaps more than 1 month better looking?
You know, I don't know. We'll have to judge. Maybe the listeners can have some kind of comparison after this podcast. So first, before I get to your expertise, there's a lot of breaking news right now on Trump, and I want to ask you what you think, because early on you were pretty cogent in prognosticating what was going to happen. You were on Sam Harris's podcast making a really coherent assessment of why Trump is a credible candidate and why he could win. Do you want to explain that? And then if you want to give me your feelings about what's going on now.
Sure. So on Sam's show, I was talking about how we could use psychology of decision making to help us understand how people make decisions. Mm-hmm. And so one of the ways that we can make decisions is to look at all of the attributes that define an alternative and then judge the package that is superior. So, for example, in the Clinton versus Trump, if we look at all of the possible attributes that define them, if you put all of them together, maybe Clinton would have been ahead. Mm-hmm. And that's called a weighted additive rule. You're looking at all of the attributes, weighing them by their importance, and picking the alternative that scores higher.
Right.
But of course, people don't always make a choice using all of the information. So for example, there's another rule called the lexicographic rule, where you only look at your most important attribute. So for example, if I were a woman looking to date a guy, maybe all I care about is his height. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I will simply choose the guy who is tallest.
Yes.
Right? That's called the lexicographic rule. So in the case of Trump—
I hate that rule. As a short man, I've been victimized by that rule.
Well, luckily for both of us, women actually don't use that rule. They do look at the full package, because otherwise both you and I would have been celibate, twirling our thumbs.
Exactly.
So anyway, so the lexicographic rule in the case of Trump would have been something akin to this. Let's suppose I really care predominantly about immigration. Mm-hmm. That's my most important attribute. So on that particular attribute, if I judge that Trump scores higher than Clinton, then it is completely rational that I might choose Trump, even though he scores lower than her on all the other attributes. So that was my prediction, mm-hmm. and it turned out to be true.
Yeah, in fact, when I listened to the way you assessed it, it made it clear why I could never vote for Hillary Clinton. I wasn't going to vote for her anyway, but it was like I listened to that podcast. I was thinking to myself, my number one overriding thing, my version of height, was terror. And I just believe that Trump had a better idea about ISIS or was less handicapped by PC culture and Islamophobia. That he would actually be willing to call the threat what the threat is and then fight the threat. And I think that's what – I think you brought that up. You might have brought that up as an example of why Trump could win because of one issue, I think.
I did do that. And I also explained to Sam that most people focus, when they think about terror, they think about the short-term perspective. So, for example, if you're talking about immigration,
right,
you look at what percentage of the 50,000 Syrians that we're letting in are likely to be ISIS members. Okay, that's an important point, but I argue that that's actually a much smaller danger than the longer-term danger, which is out of the 50,000 people, what percentage of these folks share our values? What percentage of them have endemic Jew hatred in their heart or homophobia or hatred towards women? Now, when you put it that way, then you recognize that it's no longer five ISIS members out of 50,000 that we have to intercept. It's rather 98% of the people who hold Jew hatred. Mm-hmm. And so by shifting the focus from a short-term perspective to a longer-term one, then you start seeing the threats to our values.
Mm-hmm. Now, you, what do you make of what's going on right now with Trump? You know, Trump was obviously everybody inside the Beltway, and we know he's a kind of an unusual, rough character, and he doesn't make it easy for his supporters. Where do you think – do you think a lot of the stuff happening this week is overblown, or are you worried or – not worried, but are you
– Look, I mean, I'm worried in the sense that I think that these guys are so committed to bringing him down, and he is so sort of loose that they'll eventually find a way to bring him down. So in that sense, I'm worried about the Democratic – integrity of the process.
Right.
Now, the reality is that this guy comes along, he violates every possible rule that the political class has established.
Right.
He parachutes himself straight to the top. He is not beholden to anybody in terms of any political influence. So everything that these folks have erected in their entire political careers, this guy comes along and completely blows it out of the water. He is a true disruptor in that sense.
Right.
And so they are like the last bastion of ISIS fighters in Raqqa who are going to go out in blazing glory, and they're going to fight hard. So they are simply unwilling to accept that the people have spoken, and they're going to do everything they can every day to fight until he goes down.
Yeah. You know, for the people that are easily triggered out there, he was using it as a meta. He wasn't saying they were actually like ISIS fighters. You know what I mean? People are going to go, oh, my God, Professor Sad said we're like ISIS. And then there's just their hair starts getting – it catches on fire. So, no, he's saying that, like, in terms of enthusiasm and desperation, that's what he – I don't know. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I always
– Oh, that's right.
I always know that, like, what tips people off, if they don't like you, they will always find something to say that you meant. Like, oh, this.
I'll give you an example of this. A few days ago, I posted a Sad Truth clip wherein I argued that postmodernists – are intellectual terrorists because they murder reason, they massacre the truth, they attack logic. And so some idiot said, well, how dare you call them terrorists? As if I literally meant that they were indistinguishable from the 19 guys who flew planes in the World Trade Center. So this kind of buffoonery is quite sad.
Speaking of buffoonery, you're on the battle lines of evolutionary science, meaning the attack on biology from social justice warriors. What we're seeing now, it used to be the left used to say that the right was anti-science, but it seems like the left is now basically saying that science is irrelevant. And it's really coming out of the arena of gender. And why don't you explain what you've been up against talking about, writing about?
Right. So I guess I would answer this in one of two ways. In my scientific work, I have sought to introduce the behavioral sciences with biology. In other words, if you wish to truly understand people's preferences, choices, emotions, behaviors, you can't study all these things without recognizing the biological processes that have led to the evolution of the human mind, right? Mm-hmm. Our human mind didn't mysteriously arise out of magic, right?
Right.
So in my scientific work, I have faced the blowback from social scientists who despise the idea that our brains are due to evolution. But then in my public engagement, I have faced a similar battle, as you correctly said, from social justice warriors who also negate the biological basis of our personhoods.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll give you one quick example. Last week, I appeared in front of the Canadian Senate, and then I gave a lecture in front of the Parliament where I was arguing for some of the dangerous, vague language of a bill that is being tabled in Canada called Bill C-16 that looks at gender identity and gender expression as hate, groups that could be targeted for hate. Now, the bill is so vague that literally anything that I were to teach in my evolutionary psychology course course, could be construed as, for example, hateful and prejudicial towards the transgendered. Mm-hmm. And so I tried to argue that, to which one senator accused me of being pro-genocide.
Right. Wow. That's amazing. You know, and you know what this – I've been thinking about this because I have a friend of mine who's been interviewing people for jobs, and he says that he's – it's you're in this climate where everybody is hypersensitive in this identity movement, people coming out of college where any expression could be seen as offensive. He interviews people, and then he's scared that to hire them because what happens if he is considered an oppressor? And I'm wondering, you know, this whole social justice warrior kick, this whole trend is going to lead to a lot of unemployed people because no one's going to want to hire somebody that they can't trust. That person could end up saying, you know what, you're a racist, you're a bigot, you're a sexist. Why? Because you said that's a beautiful dress, or you know what I mean? You held the door open, and that leads to some kind of attack against you. People would just rather not. People just hire their friends, you know.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, the example you gave with opening the door, there's an actual formal, quote, academic term for that. This is known as benevolent sexism. Mm. So the idea is that, yes, of course, there's hostile sexism, the type that we are used to or are aware of. But even when you are chivalrous to a woman, if you intervene to help her from four guys who are attacking her, or you open the door for her, or you say, my God, you look lovely today. All of these, while not hostile sexism, become a form of benevolent sexism. So to be kind to a woman is itself sexist. So imagine if you are inculcated with this kind of mind cancer, and then you actually have to naturally interact with people, you become very insecure because you no longer, your instincts of how to behave are so confused that you, as you said, you walk on eggshells. And this is why, by the way, I hear from a lot of women. So I've heard, for example, from several Scandinavian women who actually have complained that they find that a lot of the Scandinavian men have become, if you like, somewhat castrated, to use one of my favorite terms, because they're afraid to actually accost women. Ultimately, women, though, wish to be approached by men. Now, if men have been taught that any approach constitutes verbal rape, well, it's going to put a bit of a chill on the capacity to flirt with one another, to engage one another. So it's a real problem.
Yeah, just to clarify, because again, I'm always looking out for the guests. When you mean accost, you mean approach. You mean like going up and saying, hey, my name's Gad. What's a nice girl doing in a place like this? Okay, blah, blah, blah. Not like construction worker, you know, yeah, slurs. And
I don't mean to mount.
Yes,
I mean
verbally
say hello.
Yeah, that's it. Just saying hi is all you're talking about. I have this, like, where do you see, let's say if all of this in this identity movement, if their wishes were fulfilled, where could this lead? What kind of world would this be?
Well, I think
here to plug, believe me.
My latest clip on my channel, I actually satirized exactly what you just asked, which is I argued that we should pass a bill called the Humans Are Not Sexual Beings or something like that Act, where we not only render Canada a genderless society, but we render it a sexless society because we don't wish to marginalize people who are chaste.
Right.
Or people who are asexual, or people who engage in what's called object sexuality, people who are in love with their cars and wish to have sex with their cars. So because there are these different expressions of sexuality or non-sexuality, we should eradicate sex because this otherwise marginalizes them. So I think that's the end goal. We basically only reproduce through in vitro fertilization.
You know, it takes a lot of headaches out of stuff, you know. Like it's amazing, like when I was growing up, that how you get nervous before a date and never have to worry about that again. By the way, you bring up sex with cars. If people don't believe that, it's true. There have been a number of cases where men have been arrested because they're having sex with a car, not in a car, but with a car in public. The human brain I know we always use contemporary technology to compare the brain, you know, like it used to be a steam engine. Now it's a computer. But it's like when there's a bug in the computer, a human will do just about anything. They'll have sex with a car, and you're going. But that's because it's like there's a bug in the hardware, or is it software? I'm not sure. You know what? I have this theory that the next step is that because people can self-identify. Like there are people that if you just Google. Self-identifying as animals. There are people that identify as animals. You can identify as kind of a woodland fairy creatures. I'm thinking, what keeps me, Greg Gutfeld, saying, you know what? I am no longer Greg Gutfeld. I'm Brad Pitt. Like, what if I can't – why can't I be so specific in my self-identification that I can pick somebody and declare that I am that person? Absurd, true, but – what right do you have to tell me that I'm wrong? I mean, we can't tell people that.
Well, this is actually already happening, right? I mean, I mentioned this in my opening remarks to the Canadian Senate. I mentioned a phenomenon known as transracialism,
yes.
Which is a similar concept to transgenderism, right? Transgenderism is it doesn't matter if I have a beard and I was born a male. Mm-hmm. If I self-identify as a Korean elderly lady, well, then that's what I am, right?
Right.
So Rachel Dolezal,
right.
Who is born white, now has argued, well, what do you mean? It wasn't anything bad that I did because I self-identify as a black person. Mm-hmm. And therefore, this is known as transracialism. So the virus of the mind that you speak of has already parasitized many people. It's here.
And it's interesting because if I were, let's say, if I were part of a group that somebody identifies as who has not gone through the 25 years of life in that group, and then suddenly, like Rachel Dolezal, is now a black person without the black history or the black experience, you know, I would be like, no, I'm sorry, you can't do that. But we are now in a culture where the only thing you could be intolerant of is perceived intolerance. Like it used to be if you were a discriminating individual, that just meant, you know, they're like, you know, there's some, you know, and now you can't, you have to accept everything. And under the, it's not just to each his own, it's you better or else. You're right, I think.
And in universities, I mean, I've talked about this in the following way. You know, the highest ideal should be the pursuit of truth, right? I mean, that's the ultimate. If you look at an apex of ideals, that's the one that we wish to reach. Of course, though, from a social justice perspective, that is completely turned upside down. The highest ideal is don't hurt feelings, right?
Right.
And therefore, for example, if I wish to do research on a particular topic that is perfectly scientifically valid, but if that research might have some downstream effects that might hurt someone's feelings, then you should not do that research. And that's actually something that I had also discussed with Sam Harris on his show. Mm. So that's really, I mean, epistemologically, philosophically, that is truly dangerous, right? Because imagine as a scientist, if I woke up every day and didn't assiduously pursue truth,
right,
but rather said, how could I navigate through my day with the hope of minimally hurting someone's feelings? It's,
wow,
grotesque.
Yeah. You would, I mean, think of all, I mean, in this regard, you can now cage science. You could say that these certain things are off limits. It's kind of like, in a way, I mean, like, we already do that with drugs. You know, we can't do drug testing with psychedelics or anything because we have perceived morally that that's wrong when we could actually help people. I know I'm going off on an odd tangent. I have two more questions, and one of them was, has this affect your you're outspoken and does this affect your professional life? Do you have any friends in the academic circles? Do students seek you out or do they avoid you?
I mean, in terms of students, knock on wood, I'd like to say that I remain a popular professor to the best of my knowledge.
Where are you? You're at McGill. Are you at McGill?
I'm at Concordia. There are four Canadian Montreal universities. Two are French. Two are English. Hmm. I'm at one of the two English ones. The
Got
two
it.
English ones are Concordia and McGill.
Got it.
And it's a huge university. I think probably 40,000 plus students. Hmm. You know, a very good university. I think professionally, the main cost that I've had to bear is the opportunities that would have come from other universities who would have otherwise wanted to poach me out of Concordia, mm-hmm, who now refuse to do so. And I know this, you know, by, I mean, factually, because I know of specific schools that were very interested in hiring me and were willing to throw huge sums of money to hire me, until another group of professors said, are you crazy? Not over our dead bodies will we allow this guy to come here. And of course, it is largely due to the fact that I am outspoken in the ways that you've described. So yes, it's difficult for them to, quote, get rid of me. I do have the protection of tenure, but you could still suffer quite a bit professionally for having a big mouth.
And you do have a big mouth, but it seems like you do have a good time. I want to point out that you did once win the award Hot Professor.
Twice.
I was waiting for you to correct me. I wanted to see. You're like, no. I won twice, and that was but that was a while ago, Gad.
But I've only gotten hotter because of the gray hair.
Exactly. But so my last question, and this is where I want you to plug your book. I read Consuming Instinct, there are arguments in here, not arguments, but there's great examples of how impossible it is to argue against gender difference. I mean, there's so many things in there that how men and women abuse different things. I think I talked about this with you maybe once before about, like, when you look at what women abuse, suntanning, and what men abuse, which is gambling. Can you explain why that is, and then plug? I mean, I just want people to go read the book, essentially.
Yeah. So the book is The Consuming Instinct: What Juicy Burgers, Ferraris, Pornography, and Gift Giving Reveal About Human Nature. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I first connected with you, I was so pleased that you had enjoyed the book and you had plugged it on your, I think, blog. So thank you very much for that. So in one of the chapters, I look at what I call dark side consumption. So these are things like excessive suntanning, pathological gambling, internet pornography, compulsive buying, eating disorders. And I demonstrate that all of these manifestations of dark side consumption tend to be very sex specific. In other words, some of them are almost exclusively male-based sufferers. Mm-hmm. So pornographic addiction, there's no place anywhere on earth where it isn't men who are the greater addicts of pornography than women. Mm-hmm. And there is no place on earth where women are not the greater compulsive buyers than men. And so then, because of this universality, in other words, because it extends across cultures, there must be some fundamental biological mechanism that is explaining these sex differences. Mm-hmm. And so what I do in that chapter is I demonstrate how each of these phenomena are, if you like, misfirings of an otherwise adaptive process. So, for example, men wish to battle for resources because ultimately that's the number one thing that women look for in men, high status and resources. Now, we can do that in many ways. We could become famous television hosts or diplomats or soccer players. Now, what if I am a young, uneducated, single male who wishes to, you know, get the resources, but I can't? Well, pathological gambling becomes one avenue by which I could instantiate that Darwinian drive.
Right.
Take, for example, suntanning. Well, suntanning, rightly or wrongly, has become associated with beauty, with health, at least in the Western context. So women who are much more likely to compete on aesthetic cues will be the ones who are much more likely to then succumb to excessive suntanning, whether it be exposure to the actual sun or going to artificial sunbeds, even though they know the consequences of sun exposure more so than men. So it's not as though they're doing it because they're more misinformed. They do it because they are instantiating this Darwinian drive.
This is what I think, what I came away with that dark side consumption, was that here is an instance where women were willing to take a risk with their own life, because we're always kind of we're always of the belief that, you know, women, they live 10% longer than we do, roughly, and they're more careful, they're the caregivers, they're safer, they take fewer risks. But here it's like that just this is a real risk, and they accept it because they choose the beauty over the risk. And I thought that was the whole book's fascinating. It's an academic tome, but you can get – I mean, if I can read it, anybody could read it, because I have about an eighth grade level of intelligence. Hey, before I go, anything else you want to plug? Anything you want to add?
I'm working on my next book, which will be looking at all of the forces, the malevolent forces that is resulting in what I call the death of the West by a thousand cuts. Mm. So things like – postmodernism, identity politics, cultural relativism, radical feminism,
wow.
You know, all of these mind viruses, when put together into this giant soup, result into the abyss of lunacy that we're currently facing.
That sounds like a fun book. It sounds like something I'm definitely going to read. And then we'll also have to get you down here to New York to do my show at some point, you know, because I think you'll have a great time and it's a lot of fun. I don't know if you've ever seen it where you are, the GG show, but...
Oh, yeah. I have. I've seen both that one and I've seen also the five, which congratulations, it's now on primetime.
I know.
You are hot.
I am hot. I'm hotter than ever. I haven't been named the hottest TV anchor, but one day that will come. So, Professor Sad, always a pleasure talking to you, and I will talk to you soon, and we'll get my people and your people together and get you down here.
Thank you so much, good sir.
Take care, man.
Cheers.